Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the May 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, one of which will be coming around next month. Since my last program, Sheldon Adelson, the multi-billionaire Las Vegas and Macau hotel and casino owner, announced that he will pump at least $100 million into Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Adelson happens to be a close confidant of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as the owner of the right-wing Israel Hayom, Israel's mostly wide-read newspaper, which is seen there as a mouthpiece for Netanyahu. Adelson's paper is the most popular in Israel, not just because it appeals to the increasingly racist underbelly of Israeli society, but because it's free. And as such, it has cut deeply into the paid circulation of Israel's other newspapers of long standing that don't have the benefit of being underwritten by a multi-billionaire with an equally large ego. By now, Adelson is probably a dual citizen since he is married to an Israeli, and several years ago gave a talk to a group of American Jews in Israel in which he expressed his regret for having served in the U.S. Army and not the so-called Israel Defense Forces. In Hillary Clinton's corner, we find Haim Saban, the Egyptian-born Israeli-American media mogul, not as wealthy as Adelson, but also a multi-billionaire, who has promised to donate whatever it takes to get her elected president. He has already given more than $30 million to both Clintons and their foundation, and back in 2008, he reportedly offered $1 million to the Young Democrats of America during a phone conversation in which he also pressed for the organization's two uncommitted superdelegates to endorse the New York Democrat. A high-ranking official with Young Democrats told the Huffington Post that just before the North Carolina and Indiana primaries in 2008, Saban called YDA President David Hart and offered what was perceived as a lucrative proposal. $1 million would be made available to the group if Hart and the organization's other uncommitted superdelegate backed Clinton against Barack Obama. Hart turned him down, but it is well to wonder how many of the Democrat superdelegates Saban has already bought for Clinton this year who aren't talking about it. In case you missed it, Saban has stated for the record, in a New Yorker profile no less, that he is a one-issue man, and that issue is Israel. If we take him at his word, and his record indicates that we should, if there is no Bernie Sanders in the race in November, a major aspect of this year's presidential election will be about which candidate, Trump or Clinton, will promise to do more to help Israel. Clinton has already promised to call the Israeli prime minister on her first day in office and invite him to the White House, and in her first week to send the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the U.S. Army over to Israel to assess its military needs, which will be addressed, as usual, by dipping into the pockets of American taxpayers. Trump, meanwhile, has declared that, if elected, Israel will have no better friend than the Donald, which leads us into the subject for today's program, a conversation with Grant Smith, director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy, about his most recent book, appropriately titled Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America. So stay tuned for that at about 20 minutes past. What is happening in Israel at the moment might prove embarrassing for both candidates, particularly Hillary, since nothing, it seems, faces Trump. On my last program, I reported to you the comments of a high-ranking Israeli general, Yair Golan, in which he compared the atmosphere in today's Israel with Nazi Germany in the 30s. After a very public spat over his remarks, in which Netanyahu criticized the general and Israel's defense minister Moshe Yaalon defended him, Netanyahu forced Yaalon to resign from the government after letting him know that he was being replaced by Netanyahu's longtime political rival, Avigdor Lieberman, a former beer hall bouncer from Moldova. The upshot for Netanyahu was that by bringing Lieberman, the leader of the ultra-right Israel Beitenu party, into the government, he added 6 seats to his coalition, giving it a comfortable 67-53 majority in the 120-seat Knesset. Even some of Israel's foremost supporters in Washington were forced to question Netanyahu's decision. One of them, David Makovsky of the AIPAC-spawned Washington Institute for Near East Policy, noted that, quote, the prime minister has made a seemingly bitter trade-off. Although he's gaining 6 seats to ensure his political survival, he has saddled himself with a fierce rival, potentially alienated a loyal, experienced defense minister, and left the door open to unfavorable international initiatives. End quote. Netanyahu had been engaged for months in an effort to bring the Labor Party into his coalition government, and just when his talks with Labor Party leader Itzhak Herzog seemed on the verge of finalization, he reversed course. Apparently, according to David Makovsky, younger ultra-right members of Netanyahu's coalition government were unhappy with some of the policy pledges demanded by Herzog and acceded to by Netanyahu, such as limiting settlement activities, reviving Palestinian-related diplomatic moves, and pressing for a regional peace conference. Herzog enumerated the pledges Netanyahu had made to him at a press conference in that, quote, I demanded to have all the agreements in writing. The prime minister refused, end quote. Thus far, wrote Makovsky, Netanyahu has neither confirmed nor denied Herzog's account. What is interesting and unusual is that Makovsky, who edited the Jerusalem Post for 10 years and was once a guest on this program, raised questions about Netanyahu's behavior and Israel's political direction that had previously been taboo with the Washington Institute. Makovsky wonders how Lieberman will work with as a defense minister and what impact he will have on Israel's foreign policy. Indeed, he points out, Lieberman takes glee in issuing very provocative statements, such as once calling on Israel to bomb Egypt's Aswan Dam. During what Makovsky refers to as, quote, the Gaza War of 2014, he was the only cabinet minister to publicly call for full Israeli reoccupation of that territory, end quote. And his appointment as defense minister will make some wonder whether, in Makovsky's words, quote, another war with Hamas is in the offing, end quote. Former Israeli Prime Minister and Defense Minister Ehud Barak was more stinging in his criticism of the week's developments. Israel has been, quote, infected by the seeds of fascism, end quote, Barak said during a TV interview on Friday night. Responding to the resignation of Yalon earlier in the day, Barak said that, quote, should be a red light for all of us regarding what's going on in the government. Life-sustaining Zionism and the seeds of fascism cannot live together, Barak told a Channel 10 interviewer, although one could argue the former inevitably produced the latter. Yalon's resignation, he said, quote, is the end of a chain that began with the case of the soldier who shot a wounded Palestinian assailant to death, Barak said in an incident that I also reported to you in the last program. Such incidents give us an X-ray image that is opposed to the will of the people. What has happened is a hostile takeover of the Israeli government by dangerous elements, and that's just the beginning. That's to illustrate his point, according to Haaretz, Barak referred to legislation promoted by ultra-right members of the coalition, including the law to lift the parliamentary immunity of Knesset members who allegedly support terrorism, and a bill to impose Israeli law on Israelis living in the West Bank. This government needs to be brought down before it brings us all down, Barak added. There are no serious leaders left in the world who believe the Israeli government, end quote. So said Barak, a former prime minister as well as foreign minister of Israel, but you didn't hear that reported in this country. Of course, his use of the word serious in reference to foreign leaders exempts the U.S. because we can be assured that neither Hillary Clinton nor Trump will have any reservations about dealing with whomever represents Israel. During a previous stint as Israel's foreign minister, beginning in Obama's first term, the White House did its best to avoid Lieberman, but it was no easy task given his position as the person formerly in charge of U.S.-Israel relations. As the Jewish Weekly Forward's Natan Gutman described it, quote, with some creative thinking and practical maneuvering, a solution was found. Lieberman hardly visited Washington as foreign minister, and the Obama administration channeled the top-level policy dialogue to then-Defense Minister Ehud Barak, who, thanks to his close ties to then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, served as de facto foreign minister, at least when it came to Israeli-American relations, end quote. There's another aspect of Lieberman's profile that is certain to cause concerns in Washington. It's his affection for his former homeland, Russia. The Forward's Gutman points out that Lieberman has never made a secret of his desire to improve ties between Israel and Russia's Putin. As doors shut in Washington, Lieberman focused his work as foreign minister on improving ties with Russia and found a warm welcome in the Kremlin. Lieberman has stressed that he does not view ties with Russia as a substitute to Israel's alliance with the United States, noted Gutman, but he has spoken frequently of the need to expand Israel's circle of allies to include Russia. With friction between Washington and Moscow on the rise after Russia's annexation of Crimea and support of Russian-speaking separatists in eastern Ukraine, plus its involvement in the Syrian war, Lieberman's approach, writes Gutman, isn't likely to buy him many friends in Washington. The White House and the neocons already have a problem with Netanyahu on that subject that they are loath to make public. It was that the Israeli prime minister refused to support U.S.-led sanctions against Moscow after Putin brought Crimea back into the Russian fold following the U.S.-backed coup to depose Ukraine President Yanukovych in 2015. The two leaders are reported to speak regularly by phone concerning Russia's activities in Syria, and on June 7th, Netanyahu will be making a state visit to Moscow following an invitation by Putin. This time around, it seems, the welcome mat in Washington, though, will be out for Lieberman. On Friday, Reuters quoted State Department spokesman John Kirby as saying, quote, "We appreciate Mr. Yalon's leadership and partnership as defense minister, and we look forward to working with his successor. Our bonds of friendship are unbreakable, and our commitment to the security of Israel remains absolute," end quote. Well, so, in fact, is Congress's occupation by Israel, and that goes ditto for the U.S. media. As happens, whenever military spending is up for discussion in the U.S. House of Representatives, a number of measures benefiting Israel are inserted, and last Friday's vote on the latest National Defense Authorization Act was no exception. As approved by the House, it once again included $600 million in missile defense cooperation. And this is the first time, no doubt, you've heard about it. The report of the vote was distributed by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency and published in Israel's Haaretz, which is where I found it. As could be expected, not a single U.S. media outlet carried the story, since informing the public about what our elected representatives in Washington are doing for Israel is something they don't want you to know about. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's official domestic lobby, not surprisingly welcomed the additional goodies for Israel that are not counted as part of the foreign aid budget. The spending, quote, "will help Israel defend its citizens against rocket and missile threats and contribute to America's missile defense," end quote, AIPAC said a day after the House approved the act. Of the $600 million, $269 million will go to over-the-short-range Iron Dome anti-missile program and development. $62 million will go to funding, and said $270 million will go to funding the longer-range Arrow and David Sling anti-missile program. The House also approved an amendment to the bill proposed by New York Democrat Brian Higgins and Georgia Republican Larry Loudermilk that authorizes the provision of assistance to Israel to protect gas fields it is developing in the Eastern Mediterranean. That's right. It will be America's job to protect Israel's gas fields, part of which happen to be in Lebanon's waters. Is there no limit to how far members of Congress will stoop to kiss the lobbies behind in the hope of extracting campaign donations from well-heeled supporters of Israel? Well, we know the answer to that one. There are no limits. As another amendment approved, authored by Illinois Republican Pete Roskam, clearly shows. It would require the president to report to Congress what assistance the United States is delivering to Israel to improve its capability to protect itself against existential threats, quote, including nuclear and ballistic missile facilities in Iran, end quote. Of course, the House version will have to be reconciled with a bill that emerges from the Senate, which began to consider it this week. But the Senate has also proved to be no shirkers when it comes to taking care of Israel. The White House has threatened to veto the bill if certain House provisions remain related to shrinking the war footing defense budget and that of the President's National Security Council. Separately, on May 13th, a bipartisan slate of four senior House members introduced a non-binding resolution urging the completion of an agreement between Israel and the U.S. to extend the military assistance package to Tel Aviv for another decade, about which I've reported to you on past programs. The resolution, introduced by Texas Republican Kay Granger and New York Democrat Nita Lowey, the top Republican and Democrat on the House Appropriations Foreign Operations Subcommittee, and Florida Republican Ileana Ross Leitinen and Florida Democrat Ted Deutsch, the top Republican and Democrat on the Middle East Subcommittee, calls for, quote, the expeditious consideration and finalization of a new, robust, and long-term memorandum of understanding on military assistance to Israel between the United States government and the government of Israel, end quote. Would that these shameless creatures show the same concern for the people of the United States, and would that the American people be informed of what they are doing? Well, as the press does occasionally mention, and I've reported here, the Obama administration and the Israeli government have been negotiating the extension of the current agreement, which expires in 2018, and which allocates to Israel at the moment over $3 billion a year in military assistance, not including the amounts added to the National Defense Act budget, which the Israelis and their paid agents in Congress have come to see as an entitlement. Obama administration officials reportedly are willing to increase the aid package to $3.7 billion, while the greedy Israelis have been demanding $5 billion. A sticking point reportedly is the Obama administration's insistence on including in the new agreement the Missile Defense Cooperation budget, which, as I mentioned a moment ago, was again included in the National Defense Authorization Act and until now has been considered separately. Israel prefers to keep it that way so it could ask for and get ad hoc increases periodically from a Congress that just can't say no when Tel Aviv comes calling. Finally, some more news you probably have not heard that deals with the Koch brothers, two of America's wealthiest businessmen whose contributions brought us a Tea Party and the Republican-controlled Congress. It appears, according to a lengthy article in the National Review, that they are not satisfied with some of the outcomes of their efforts and plan to stay out of the presidential race, although Charles Koch said he might possibly support Clinton. Instead, they are planning to focus on changing American policy in various arenas, and last week in Washington, they began to do that by hosting a forum on U.S. foreign policy that featured four men, three widely respected academics, and a former U.S. ambassador that are high up on the Israel lobby's hate list. The three academics were John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, authors of the groundbreaking book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which attributed the Iraq War to Israel's U.S. backers, and Andrew Bacevich, who you have heard a number of times both on this program and Joy LeClaire's Forthright Radio. The former ambassador was Charles Freeman, ambassador to Saudi Arabia, whose appointment by Obama to head the National Intelligence Council was shot down by Israel's domestic censors led by the well-known liberal attorney Alan Dershowitz. The Charles Koch Institute's decision to host a conference that features Walt, Mearsheimer, and Freeman is in keeping with a general realignment of U.S. politics in 2016, wrote Bloomberg Report's Eli Lake. Under George W. Bush and Barack Obama, he says, conservatives have embraced Israel and accused their partisan foes of not supporting the Jewish state, but this year has brought a shift. The Koch brothers have always leaned libertarian in their political giving and nonprofit work, wrote Lake. In foreign policy, however, the Kochs have stayed away from the uglier fringes that blame Israel and its supporters for hijacking U.S. foreign policy. That is, until now, observed Lake. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.